28. This chapter that we read a few minutes ago, and we're only going to consider a very short part of it this morning. It's verses 16 and 17. Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 and 17. So verse 16 reads, "Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them." So here then we have Jesus having a get-together with his disciples. And many things about this get-together are familiar. The location is familiar. It's Galilee, there in the far north of Israel, the region that Jesus had met most of these disciples in the first place, and where they'd spent most time together. Not only is the location familiar, but the landscape is familiar. They're on a mountain. Just as often in the past, they had been together on mountains, the Sermon on the Mount, the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus' Palm Sunday arrival in Jerusalem down the Mount of Olives. But not only are the location and the landscape familiar, but the dynamics among the group are also familiar here. Matthew says that Jesus had directed them to get together at this point and in this place. Just as in the past then, Jesus here is taking charge. He's taking the initiative. He's the master in this group with whose instructions they all comply. And so in these ways then, I'm saying this is a familiar scene that we have in Matthew 28, verse 16. A get-together between Jesus and his disciples in Galilee, on a mountain, at Jesus' instigation. It seems very much like business as usual. But, at the same time, in a couple of ways, this get-together is actually quite strange and unprecedented. It isn't business as usual. For these disciples, hanging out with Jesus in Galilee now will feel quite different than it did before. For one thing, they now lack one member of their group. There are now 11 men, we're told, not 12 men. That, of course, is because Judas Iscariot has now defected. And then for another thing, and most strangely of all, they now have a master who has died and come back to life again. They had previously frequented these Galilean haunts with Jesus the miracle worker, with Jesus the healer, with Jesus the exorcist. And so there'd always been a certain sense of wonder and mystery involved, but now they are there with the risen Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, the grave vacating Jesus. This is new and uncharted territory for them. And that's the backdrop then to the next verse, the fascinating verse 17, where we read, "And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted." And I think at least three things are worth noting here. And first of all then, the honesty of the writer. That's the first thing that's worth noting here. The honesty of the writer. You probably haven't heard of Charles Douglas. Charles Douglas was an American television engineer who in the 1950s invented laugh tracks. Now laugh tracks are those bursts of pre-recorded laughter which punctuate many TV comedies, whether it's Basil Fawlty being irritable towards his hotel guests or Mr. Bean getting himself into some improbable scrapes. We're familiar with this device, aren't we? With every joke or humorous situation that occurs, we hear these unseen people laughing. I once read an article in the New York Times that was analysing this phenomenon. And the writer was very damning then about these laugh tracks, referring to them as obvious fig leaves for the embarrassment of weak punchlines. And he asked the question then in the article, why are they still so widely used? And he continued, Robert Provine, a professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, suggests one somewhat uncomfortable answer. Actually, the professor says, laugh tracks do increase the likelihood that you'll think a joke is funny and laugh at it. What Charles Douglas was doing was based in fact. And so you see what's being said there then. When it comes to laughter, we human beings don't simply respond to the joke itself, but we also respond to the response of others to the joke itself. And of course, it isn't just to laughter then that this kind of psychology applies. And it isn't just producers of TV comedy who have tapped into it. Some of you will have come across David Blaine, the American illusionist. And in more recent times, he specialized in these very spectacular high-profile endurance stunts, like being encased in a block of ice or being suspended over the River Thames for a long period of time, that kind of thing. But in his earlier TV shows, they focused on so-called street magic. So he would be filmed then gathering an impromptu audience in the streets and squares of American cities and doing tricks for them. But the filming style was very interesting. Listen to one description. Blaine revolutionized the way magic is shown on television by focusing on spectator reactions. His idea was to turn the camera around on the people watching instead of the performer to make the audience watch the audience. And so it's the same kind of psychology now applied to amazement rather than laughter. And the point is then that we're more likely to respond with amazement to a guy hovering 6 inches off the ground or swallowing shards of glass or whatever it might be if there are these others who are also responding with amazement to it. That's the thinking behind those David Blaine shows. Now, here's Matthew. And he wants us to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. What would be a good way of him subtly pushing us in that direction? What would Charles Douglas or David Blaine say? Well, they would say, if you want to get laughter, then create the impression of others, an original audience that's laughing. If you want to get amazement, then show an original audience being amazed. And if you want to get eager belief in a risen Jesus, therefore, describe an original audience eagerly believing in the risen Jesus. That's what they would advise. And so Matthew comes then to verse 17 here, and he writes, and when they saw him, these 11 disciples, when they saw him, they worshipped him, and every single one of them was thoroughly and absolutely convinced that Jesus had risen. Doesn't say that, does he? But some doubted, he says. But some doubted. And you think, Matthew, why are you saying that? Why are you undermining your case here? Why are you ignoring these basic principles of human psychology? To which Matthew's answer would be, I'm saying it because it's true. Because some of those 11 men did entertain fleeting doubts that this really was the risen Jesus standing in front of them. I'm not interested in the principles of human psychology. I'm not interested in using techniques to compel a certain response among my readers. I'm interested in accurately reporting what took place. That's what Matthew would say. And so you see what I mean then by my first heading this morning, the honesty of the writer. And what's the big deal about this then? Well, the big deal about this is that it means we have every reason to believe Matthew's account of Jesus' resurrection. Those details that you heard read earlier in our service this morning about an earthquake and about an angel rolling a huge stone away and about an empty tomb, and about frightened women being met by the living Jesus who's so alive that they can physically hold on to him. And it's so easy to read those or listen to those verses, isn't it, and say, ah, well, Matthew's just making all this up. But you see, if the truth mattered to Matthew so little at that point in the chapter, why does the truth suddenly matter so much to him now in verse 17? If Matthew feels free to fabricate a resurrection account, why doesn't he also feel free to tell us all the disciples immediately accepted that Jesus had risen from the dead? Or at least, why doesn't he feel free to omit the awkward fact that some of them doubted it? It doesn't make sense, does it? The only reason that Matthew would mention the disciples' doubts is if Matthew is a scrupulously honest historical reporter. And if Matthew is a scrupulously honest historical reporter, then you and I must take seriously this morning his report of Jesus rising from the dead. Are you? Are you taking that seriously? Which leads us on then to the second thing that's worth noting here in our text. We've seen the honesty of the writer. Secondly, the significance of the resurrection. The significance of the resurrection. So Matthew then, because he has this honest approach to reporting the facts, Matthew mentions these doubts. But notice, of course, that while they may, that little phrase may catch our eye, the doubts of the disciples are not the main point here in verse 17. Those three words, but some doubted, they're a bit of an add-on, actually. The main point of this verse is these words: and when they saw him, they worshipped him. And when they saw him, they worshipped him. Now that's interesting. You see, when Matthew says that these men worship Jesus, he's not simply saying that they were amazed at Jesus. He's not simply saying that they were wowed by the spectacle of the risen Jesus. He's not simply saying that they were blown away by this encounter with a man whom they had seen die on a cross a couple of days earlier. No, worship in the Bible is not a vague concept that's broadly equivalent to those things. Worship is very specific. Worship is the necessary reaction, the necessary response of human beings in the presence of God. That's what worship is. Worship is the necessary response of human beings in the presence of God. In 2007, the late comedian and actor Robin Williams visited US troops in Kuwait. And as well as meeting a lot of them personally, he also performed a stand-up routine for them. And this stand-up routine for these troops in Kuwait, it didn't exactly go according to plan. He was in mid-flow in his act when suddenly, without any warning, a trumpet began to sound. And as soon as this trumpet began to sound, his audience, all of them soldiers in their uniform, his audience, to a man, stood up, turned their back on the stage, and on him therefore, and remained in a standing position with their backs to him for a good 3 or 4 minutes. Williams didn't have a clue what was going on. He just fell silent, as it was really the only option, until the trumpet had finally stopped sounding, and at that point his audience turned back round again, took their seats again, and he was able to resume the show. Now, the reason for this interruption then was what is known in the US military as retreat. That is the American flag being brought down at the end of the day. And when retreat occurs then, standing to attention facing the flag is just what you have to do. And Robin Williams may be performing on stage right there in front of you. It doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. You have to do it. It's the necessary response. And worship is like that. Worship is the necessary response of human beings in the presence of God. Jesus. So why then do these 11 men worship Jesus here? Okay, he has just risen from the dead, and sure, that's pretty impressive. But does rising from the dead demonstrate conclusively that someone is God? And how do we know that it does? To decide that resurrection is a proof of being God just seems a little bit arbitrary, does it not? Growing up in North Yorkshire, I always found it very strange that Ripon was a city. Ripon was a tiny place. Didn't have a train station, didn't have a professional football team, didn't have a Marks and Spencers. Why should having a cathedral, impressive as Ripon's cathedral is, mean that you're a city? And similarly then, why should being raised from the dead, impressive as resurrection is, why should that mean that you are God? Well, I don't think that's the point. This, I think, is the point. Jesus, throughout his life on earth, had made some staggering claims. He claimed that he had authority to forgive people's sins. Not just wrongs that had been directly committed against him, just people's sins generally, people's sins per se. He claimed that he already existed before the time of Abraham in 2000 BC. He claimed that one day he will sit on a throne and judge all the nations of the world. In other words, Jesus had claimed to be God. Jesus had claimed to be God. Now, many of the Jews who heard then Jesus making those claims, and especially the religiously important ones, they hated him for making those claims. They just regarded him as a wicked blasphemer for making those claims. What about his disciples? What did they make of Jesus saying such things about himself? Well, they hadn't disbelieved him and hated him for it. But nor had they really embraced those claims and responded to them. You know how it is sometimes when someone close to you tells you some piece of news, and that piece of news just seems so extraordinary, so unthinkable, that you can't quite respond to it as true and real. And it's not then that you reject it and distrust it. You love this person who's told you it, and you trust completely everything they ever say. But it's that rather than processing it and putting it in a category, true, untrue, possibly true, like we do with most things as they arrive in our minds, you just kind of leave this piece of information sitting there, an unprocessed lump in your mental vaults. Like the big box that we have in our kitchen at the moment, because of the chaos that we're in with the builders being in, and it's a box of books and it's just there. And we don't touch it, we don't do anything with it, we just step over it, we work around it, it's just there. Some of you will know that kind of experience. And we can have things like that in our minds, can't we? Things that we just leave sitting there and we don't really process them or engage with them. And I think then that Jesus' claims to be God were like that in the disciples' minds. They were just so sensational, these claims, so out of this world, the disciples almost couldn't bring themselves to properly engage with them. And so they were just allowing those claims to sit there unprocessed. And what happens now is that Jesus' resurrection shakes them out of that. I mean, the claims of a man who has risen from the dead cannot but be taken seriously. And so suddenly, these claims are now allowed to sink in and to hit home. And it's like these men are now being internally pummeled by a mound of claims which over 3 years have built up in their memory banks. Wow! He forgives people's sins. Wow, he existed before Abraham was alive. Wow, he's one day going to judge the nations. He must be God. How didn't we see this properly before? Jesus is God. Therefore, we must bow down and worship him. And so, I'm saying in the first place this morning, Matthew is an honest writer. And we must take seriously, therefore, his report of Jesus' resurrection. And I'm saying in the second place this morning, Jesus' resurrection is hugely significant. Now, it's significant for lots of reasons, but not least this one. It indicates that Jesus' claims are true claims. I mean, yes, ordinarily speaking, a random guy 2,000 years ago going around saying he's God doesn't deserve a hearing. I mean, any desperate self-publicist can do that. But when a guy goes around saying he's God and then dies and then rises again from the dead, his claims aren't so easily dismissed, are they? He deserves a hearing. That astonishing re-emergence from the grave lends a certain irrefutability to his claims. That, I'm saying, is the significance of the resurrection. And perhaps this morning then, the resurrection of Jesus Christ ought to drive you back to the claims of Jesus Christ. And in the light of those staggering claims that he made, perhaps you need to emulate those soldiers in Kuwait. And you need to just drop what you're doing. Drop your plans, drop your goals, drop your ambitions, drop your pursuits that are so absorbing you and preoccupying you and are so much at the center of your life. They are like Robin Williams' act. There's something more pressing than them. Jesus Christ is God. That's the most pressing reality that's confronting you this morning. That is the most pressing reality confronting you this morning. Jesus Christ is God. And the necessary response is to devote the rest of your life to worshiping him. So the honesty of the writer, the significance of the resurrection. And then the third thing worth noting in this verse, the beauty of the gospel. The beauty of the gospel. What's the gospel? Well, the word gospel means good news. So the gospel is the Bible's good news. What is the Bible's good news? Well, the Bible's good news is that through Jesus, human beings can be forgiven of all the sins that they have committed against God, and for which they must otherwise, without that forgiveness, be punished. The gospel is that through Jesus, human beings can enter into a happy and harmonious relationship with their Maker. The good news is that through Jesus Christ, human beings can have the prospect of endless bliss in a future new world. Through Jesus, these and many more wonderful things are available to all men and women and boys and girls. That is the Bible's good news. That's the gospel. Now, here's the million-dollar question. What is the gospel's requirement? Those are the offers, the great benefits that the gospel offers, but what then is the gospel's requirement? In other words, how does a person access these wonderful things that are available through Jesus? What's required? Well, I suppose an obvious answer to that question that you'll find among many people perhaps who go to church, but have never themselves really properly read the Bible. The obvious answer is that it's being good. That's the requirement. It's being decent. It's being respectable. It's being a rule-keeping sort of person. Being good is the gospel's requirement. Well, let me tell you, that answer is incorrect. That answer could not be more incorrect. That answer is diametrically opposed to the correct answer. And boy, am I glad this morning that that answer is incorrect. Because if being good were the requirement, then that would put the gospel well out of my reach. There's way too much badness in my heart. I would never qualify. Not in a million years would I qualify for the gospel if the gospel's requirement was, you must be good. So what is the requirement then? Well, according to the Bible, the requirement is faith. This is perhaps best expressed in a verse that many of you will be familiar with. It's Acts chapter 16, verse 31. A man has asked the Apostle Paul, what must I do to be saved? In other words, to receive that forgiveness of sins and that happy relationship with my Maker and that eternal future, what must I do? And Paul replies, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. So belief or faith in the Lord Jesus is the gospel's requirement. But this is the thing. Many people hear that and they say, okay, so I have to have really good faith then. Faith that's deep and strong and impressive. That's what's required. And again, that is incorrect. Just as the gospel doesn't say come and be saved by being good, nor does it say come and be saved by having good faith. And if you want proof of that, look at these disciples here. Was their faith good? Was their faith deep and strong and impressive? Was their faith exemplary textbook faith? Not at all. But some doubted, Matthew says. Are these then non-Christians? Are these enemies of the gospel? No, these are Christians. These are the disciples of Jesus. But their faith was flimsy and stuttering and inconsistent. It was a flawed faith, infected with doubts and misgivings. But it was sufficient. It was real faith. It was true faith. It met the gospel's requirement and secured for them all the wonderful things available through Jesus. And this is what I mean then by the beauty of the gospel. You go to some amusement venue and there's one of those claw machines. So a big transparent box full of goodies. And those goodies are all right there in front of you and they look so accessible, don't they? But of course they're not really accessible. You have to put money in. And then there's the maneuvering of that claw, which of course is very difficult to do. Or it's the same with these fairground stalls, and you have to shoot with some kind of gun, you have to shoot at a target. And all the possible prizes that you could win are lined up on the shelves, the back of the stall there. And again, they're all in front of you, and they all look so accessible. All you have to do is shoot this target, and you could have anything you want from those shelves. But again, of course, they're not really as accessible as they seem to be, because it's fiendishly difficult to hit the target, and you walk away with some silly teddy bear or something, the least attractive prize on those shelves. But I'm saying, here's this biblical gospel. And it's beautiful. Not only are the riches on offer here immeasurably greater than those you will find in any claw machine or in any fairground stall, but they're also accessible. I mean, truly accessible, not just apparently accessible. They're not just held out before us. And then we find that there's no way we can reach them. No, they are truly accessible. Because you get at them, not through being good, but through faith. And not through mega faith, but through mere faith. You see, faith is simply clinging on to this Jesus, who is the source of all these wonderful benefits. The other morning, I got onto a metro train at Four Lane Ends, and it was rush hour, and the metro was packed, and you had to really squeeze on in order to not be trapped by the doors as they shut. And there was this mother with a little boy, and they were standing there in this packed carriageway, and the mother said to him, "Just keep hold of me, keep hold of me." And I could see him at points during that train ride, and he sometimes only had a little fold of her trousers. That was all that he was holding on to, but he was just about holding on all the way through that train ride. And that's faith. It's just clinging on to Jesus. And faith that just clings on to a little fold in his garment is sufficient. And so we don't need to ask ourselves the question this morning, have I got it in me to be a Christian and to be part of this gospel and to receive all the wonderful things that are in this gospel, forgiveness of my sins and a right standing with God and all the rest of it? No, we don't need to ask such questions. It's not about me. Have I got it in me? You see, Christianity is sometimes portrayed as being about great Christians. Christianity is about a great Christ. And all we limp, hobbling, weak human beings have to do is cling on to him. And if we cling on to him, then we will benefit from everything that Jesus offers to all who come to him. Will you come to this accessible gospel this morning? This accessible Jesus? This accessible forgiveness? This accessible healing of your broken person? Will you come to Jesus? Not with great faith, but to a great Saviour. Jesus hasn't put himself and his gospel just that little bit too high so that nobody can really reach hold of it. It's low, it's right where you're at. Anybody can reach hold of it. You can this morning. Come, like these weak men here in our passage, these full of doubts men, come and like them, cling on to Jesus, and you will be saved. Amen.